Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Nadege Green. Thanks for listening. Tom Hudson is out this week. This week in Coral Springs, students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High and other schools, parents, and elected officials introduced a new organization called 17 for Change. The 17 is for the 17 students and staff members who were killed in the Parkland shooting. The group will advocate for stricter gun laws and track the National Rifle Association's contributions to Florida elected officials. Ara Johnson is a Pembroke Pines High School student who is on the 17 for Change advisory board.
This is what we are doing today, and we will do more tomorrow, and we will do more the next day until no man, no woman, no child, no American will ever have to live in fear of gun violence again.
The group hopes to create a platform for more community engagement around this issue. In the meantime, some student survivors at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School say their voices have not been heard. A group of Black students called a press conference to talk about their concerns this week. Tia Amoy Roberts says she's proud of the work she and her peers in the Never Again movement are doing, but she added youth-led activism around guns and killings isn't new.
The Black Lives Matter movement has been addressing this topic since the murder of Trayvon Martin in 2012. Yet we have never seen this kind of support for our cause, and we surely do not feel that the lives or voices of minorities are valued as much as those of our white counterparts.
Making sure different voices and perspectives are being amplified and supported in this youth-led movement and what comes next. In studio today with us, we have Nancy Ankrum, editorial page editor for the Miami Herald. Thank you for joining us, Nancy.
Thank you.
Rosemary O'Hara, editorial page editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
And Carolyn Gunnis, editor of the Miami Times. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Carolyn, we'll start with you. Where do you see this going, this wave of activism among teenagers?
Well, I think the activism overall reminds me of SNCC back in the day. And I think, it's a First Amendment issue versus the Second Amendment. So it seems like the answer might be in the courthouse. I think it's heading there.
Nancy, what happens next? We're seeing all of these students who are raising their voices around this issue, and they say they're not going away. This is just the beginning.
Right. They say they're not going away. We will have to see. They need to stay focused. They need to stay committed. Graduation time is coming. Summer is coming. Will the impetus weaken? Will it decrease? I'm hoping that they take some information from the women's marches that we've seen, where the question was, well, what's going to happen after that? You know, we all had a great party in D.C., and now what? Well, we see a fair amount of women across the country running for office. We see the Me Too movement that I don't doubt really grew out of that. The movement is going to have to move local, where people in their cities, in their neighborhoods, in their communities are going to have to keep the momentum going. We might not see it on TV all the time, but that's where the real progress will be made.
And Rosemary, I was in Broward speaking to youth in Broward, and it sounds they're already heading there. They're talking about addressing the folks who are running for Broward Sheriff, for example, and talking about local elections, bringing their demands to the Broward County School Board even. How do you keep this going on a local level? And should politicians be concerned? Many of the students who are raising their voices right now are going to turn 18 soon.
Right. I don't see any signs of it going away. I see the momentum and the pedal to the metal on this cause. So the next step in their journey are these town halls. They have called for every member of Congress to have a town hall, I believe, on April 7th. And so now we've got in Broward, Ted Deutsch has said he'll have one. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is having one. They've got a website of who has agreed to have the town hall and who hasn't. So they're now pressuring people to have these town halls. And if you remember back in the immigration days about town halls, you know, the kind of people who show up, the power, the energy. It's why a lot of members of Congress stopped having town halls, is because they didn't like the people who were showing up. So the town hall issue, and then we also saw what happened just this week with David Hogg and his Laura Ingraham, the Fox commentator, calling him out as for, you know, complaining that he didn't get in. Yeah, he got right back in her face with a list of advertisers and his 500,000 followers, and got her to apologize last night as advertisers started falling away. So this, because of the power of social media and how many people are following them, and I don't know who all is advising them, but the primaries are in August. So it's not that far away. And so I think the pressure is high.
Social media absolutely is playing a role in this. Social media is the town hall for youth. That is where conversations happen. That is where conversations start and continue to go on. But we're also talking about what this means when we're talking about local and from the perspective of youth, the different voices of youth who are represented. Carolyn, we see kids from all different parts of Florida talking about this. You had a reporter out from March for Our Lives who was embedded with youth from Liberty City, from Miami Gardens. What does this mean for just talking about the issue of gun violence and gun reform from the different perspectives locally that it impacts young people?
Well, the young people locally are saying that they have been wanting a platform. They've been needing a platform. They live with gun violence daily, hourly, and it seems like they hadn't been able to get any momentum, any traction. And so they said, well, let's join, you know, you're greater in numbers, so let's join the numbers. But they said when they got to Washington, they marched, but they didn't feel like they marched. It was sort of like a lip service in that, yes, we're saying it's all inclusive. It is just gun violence, but it still felt like it was about something else.
So they didn't feel that they were addressing the specific issue, or in this moment, they weren't addressing the specific issue of how gun violence impacts them on the neighborhood level. What were the students talking about, though? The kids from Miami who went from the march, from Miami Gardens, from Liberty City, what were some of their concerns? What were some of the things that they want to see on a policy level even?
Well, I'm not sure that they were talking about policy. I think right now they were just talking about, can we get a seat at the table? Can someone address what it is that we deal with daily? Our schools, maybe the shooting is not happening on the campus, but it's certainly happening outside the door on their way home, just walking. I had one student who, it was early release day, and he was walking, and he was shot at. And, you know, so, but those conversations, there are no cameras for them. There's no conversation that's talking about the safety in your own neighborhood.
That there are no cameras for them, and I would add, no reporters who have notepads either for them. Nancy, part of this is media. Who do you show up for and who we're covering?
Right.
And whether or not these voices are also being amplified in the media in the same way that we're seeing in the Parkland shooting, how do we do that?
Well, you know, it is same old, same old. We're talking about violence now, but substandard education, are the media there to the degree that they should be? Not necessarily. Healthcare, in inner city neighborhoods, in black neighborhoods, in brown neighborhoods, do the media show up with the same intensity and the same degree? No, of course not. So this is really, unfortunately, business as usual for a lot of media outlets. Not all, but a lot of media outlets, especially if we're talking about national media. Locally based media can do a better job, can be more accessible, but again, there also needs to be a savvy and a commitment and a push on the parts of those whose voices are not being heard to keep this issue in front of the media itself.
And so, Rosemary, when we're talking about who is going to pay attention to these young people, we have seen, I mean, the Florida legislature moved you know, Florida is known as the gunshine state, and we have some legislation, at least, that's addressing gun reform, even though it doesn't go as far as some groups would like for it to go. We have seen even local politicians who are now meeting with students who are like, we want to hear what you have to say. How do we keep that going? How do we keep this conversation going among young people and the adults who are in a position to make change?
Well, I think the people who are most willing to speak to the issue and speak to the students and address gun violence, unfortunately, are one political party. And that the members of the Republican Party are gun shy about having this conversation. And because our country is so culturally divided on so many issues, it's like on guns, you know, there's, you're either for it or against it. On climate change, you believe it or you don't. On health care, you know, it's an entitlement or it's not. It's every issue. And so, you know, the odds of getting change in Washington sound minuscule, although in the budget bill that just passed, they did say that finally that the CDC can do research on gun violence.
But so no funding. There's no funding.
That's exactly right. You know, and apparently they did something to improve, encourage states to report the names of people who are mentally ill and shouldn't be allowed to have guns. So there was a minuscule baby step, but I don't see action coming in Washington with the current environment. And that's why the only alternative is what the kids are talking about. And that is, you know, vote them out, get change who's sitting in those seats, get kids registered to vote, support people who get help people get to the polls, fund people who are running, run for office yourself. The only way to make change is to change who's sitting in the seats.
And speaking on voting, many of these students say that they're going to be hosting voter drives in their communities. They are actively on campus. In fact, in some of the schools where they had walkouts a few weeks ago, among the walkout activities were registering seniors to vote. So we will definitely see more of that. We're going to leave for now the youth-led activism and turn to affordable housing, which is hard to find in South Florida. Could the answer be in building homes for teachers on school campuses? That's coming up next here on the Florida Roundup. I'm Nadege Green. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Affordable housing, it is a challenge here in South Florida, and Miami-Dade County School District has a proposal to help its employees. The district is considering using its own properties on or near school campuses to build housing for teachers. For example, a new middle school planned for the Brickell area could have apartments for teachers on one of its floors. Also being considered is a 300-unit apartment complex next to Phyllis Wheatley Elementary School in Overtown. Teacher salaries are not keeping up with the soaring costs of rent. Could living on school campuses solve that problem? We want to hear from you. Maybe you're a teacher or have thoughts about this proposal. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. We're joined in studio still by Rosemary O'Hara, editorial page editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Carolyn Gunness, editor of the Miami Times, and Nancy Ankrum, editorial page editor for the Miami Herald. Nancy, the Miami Herald, the editorial board, wrote an op-ed in support of this, that this could be a possible solution. What's the appeal about this idea?
Well, it could be a possible small solution to a small population of people who do need help. Affordable housing in this community is practically non-existent, as everything goes luxury condo and very, very expensive. And we did see this as a way to provide housing that people who are gainfully employed can afford without a commute, without adding to traffic in the streets, without having to rely on public transportation in this community, which remains inadequate in too many ways. You know, the devil, of course, will be in the details, in the execution of how this plays out.
This is a big talk story. I have been seeing so much on social media from teachers, from family members of teachers. People have questions, and this is very preliminary. This is just a proposal. But Carolyn Gunness, what are you hearing? What has been some of the feedback since this has come out that this is a proposal that the district is considering?
Well, you know, they're planning to build those apartments right smack dab in the middle of the Black community, and yet...
The one in Overtown specifically.
Yes, the Phyllis Wheatley School. And it's sort of like, well, when are we going to have a conversation? Can they talk to us first? You know, yes, it is preliminary, but where are the community meetings to talk about this and educate people? I mean, it was so jarring for everyone to wake up and see, oh, yeah, we're going to just take some land and we're going to build in your neighborhood. It seemed like more gentrification. What basically they're saying is, if you want to do something for teachers, just pay us what we're worth so we can afford to live where we want to live.
Pay us what we're worth. Rosemary, this is a conversation across county lines. Teachers struggling to make a living. They are teaching our children. They are putting in work. They are putting in extra hours, buying things out of their own pockets to make sure that they have the supplies they need in school, but they can't afford to live in the communities. What happens? What happens next?
Yeah, no, and to that list, I would only add that we now expect our teachers to be first responders as well.
Right. All right.
What happens is that, you know, in Tallahassee, which is responsible for funding schools, there just isn't the support for giving teachers the kind of salaries that they deserve. And instead, they kind of beat up on the teachers, you know? It's like they do failure factories, and it's unfortunate. But it's not just teachers that are suffering from not being able to afford housing in South Florida. As Nancy said, all those high-rises don't have rents or purchase prices that moderate-income families can afford. And so let me point the finger back at Tallahassee for a minute, and that's that we have a trust fund to help support affordable housing, moderately priced housing in our communities. And they raided the trust fund again this year in order to harden the schools. So, you know, it's like, okay, we thought we were going to get some programs to get some apartments and better homes in communities. They keep raiding that every year so that they can give tax breaks and spend money elsewhere. But the issues of teacher salaries and affordable housing are not on the agenda of Tallahassee.
And let's not forget the politics of it. This is not just Tallahassee dismissing teachers' good work. It's about unions mm-hmm. that normally support Democrats. It's about giving money. The charter schools made out very well this year.
Right.
With our funds. With
taxpayer funding.
With taxpayer funding. And charter schools do not have to play by the same rules, do not have to admit everybody the way a public school does. They can pay their teachers a living wage and beyond. And those are, I think we saw a story today that the wives of several state legislators are on the boards of charter schools.
And speaking of charter schools, some of those teachers have the same issues when right. it comes to affording housing in Miami, being able to afford housing in Miami-Dade County. They're in this boat, too. We put out a call to our listeners on how they feel about this, and we got so much responses back, so many responses. Melissa from Lake Worth said she thinks this is a brilliant idea. She says she's visited family in Oregon, and there are other places around the country where this is a model, where school boards are also in the business of subsidizing housing or building housing on their properties. She was like, and there was a waiting list. There was a waiting list for this. LaShonda in North Miami talked about having to move into her family's home because she could not afford rent where she works. And she supports this idea as well. But you also had Mauricio from the Hammocks, who does not think this is a good idea. He talked about work-life balance and the idea that if you live next door to where you work, the very elusive work-life balance becomes even more elusive. You know, will this impact how teachers are able to balance their private lives and privacy issues even? On the housing side of things, how much will the school district know about you? And so this has raised a lot of conversation starting off, but one consensus is that we need affordable housing. There needs to be affordable housing. We're going to take one call, Yvonne from Kendall. Yvonne, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Yvonne.
Listen, politicians will not change laws because they feel a change of heart, only when they feel the heat. And nobody feels the heat from teachers. We have no power. I'm a retired teacher. We have absolutely no power to make them feel the heat. So, in the interim, if they want to build houses to help out, I say go for it. This is a model in the Caribbean that I have seen for myself, where you have certain school personnel that lives close to the school. It's practical. I know it's not perfect, but it's a help. Because let's face it, in Florida, in Miami, affordable housing is just not there anymore.
Thank you so much, Yvonne. Affordable housing just isn't here, and teachers may not get enough respect for Yvonne, a retired teacher. And a quick correction, Melissa from Lake Worth, the example that she gave wasn't actually a teacher housing facility in Oregon. It was a veterans housing facility for tiny houses, which we're also talking about here in Miami-Dade County. The Miami-Dade County Commission recently passed a resolution to study and explore changing its zoning laws to allow tiny houses, homes under 300 feet, to be built here, again, to try to address this issue of affordable housing. Nancy, I see you kind of shaking your head. Tiny houses?
I don't know. You know, I haven't given it much thought, I have to admit. It seems to be a model that is interesting. I'm always concerned that when communities come up with these ideas, are they reinforcing the segregation of the city? You know, when I see people interviewed in other cities of who these homes are being made available for, formerly homeless people, people of low income. I'm very concerned that I don't see people of color among them, and that these innovations are just hardening lines of segregation and separation in those cities. And hey, this is Miami. Why should we be any different?
We're talking about affordable housing, a proposal to house teachers on school campuses. Maybe tiny houses might be an option for Miami-Dade County. Call us. We want to hear from you at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet at us at WLRN. I mean, Carolyn, can you talk a bit about just where we are now when it comes to affordable housing and some of the creative workarounds even that you're seeing for people to be able to live here with their families and still show up at school and teach our students?
Our big problem is that we're not stepping back and seeing what we want to accomplish, right? We say we have a brain drain. The kids can't stay because they have no place to live. They can't afford to live here based on the salary they're going to get after they get educated. Okay, so let's build these tiny houses so that they can live in it, 275 square feet and up. But the rents are almost the same as regular. So who is winning here? It sounds like the de facto is the developers. It seems like every problem that we have, we solve it with rewarding developers. And the Urban Institute last year, they did a study, and they said Miami-Dade County needs 2.8 bedrooms per family. That's what is lacking here. So I'm not sure how the tiny houses are going to help. And secondly,
And to the point, tiny houses are really tiny. And we know that most households in Miami-Dade County, especially when we talk about who is leading households, are actually single-led households by women with children. And so, I don't know, maybe if you're a single person or one-in-one, a two-person household, that might work. It might not work for a larger family of three, right, or four even here in Miami-Dade County. Another teacher, not a teacher, but one of our listeners, Camilla, she wrote into us and she told us she doesn't think it's healthy to live on school campuses. She doesn't think teachers will have a time to kind of decompress and get away from everything if you live on campus. Could that be an issue?
You know, I would point out that there is history for this, and that is on college campuses. It's not unusual for universities to offer faculty housing, and it's a way to, you know, help people who don't make great salaries. And then I remember it wasn't just, I don't know, 5-7 years ago, we started seeing community colleges start building housing on campus. And it's like, wow, community college? I thought those were for commuters, you know? And suddenly it's like they're getting into the business of housing. And so now to see school districts go there, I think it's an interesting, an idea well worth exploring. I would share one, but to Nancy's point that the devil's in the details. There was an example of a housing program on school campuses in Broward that had school resource officers living on campus. In fact, Scott Peterson, the SRO who did not go into Marjory Stoneman Douglas, was one of those school officers who lived on a school campus. And they got free, they got to put their mobile home on the campus, get free rent, utilities. The idea was that because they were there, they'd respond to emergency calls or break-ins after hours. Program didn't work out like they thought. You know, they didn't respond to 75% of the calls. And so, and nobody was following up.
I guess they found that work-life balance. When I'm off duty, I'm off duty.
So the devil's in the details. They didn't follow up on that one because housing is not something they know how to do. If they get into this one, they better hire people who know how to do housing.
Details, trying to figure out the details of how to create affordable housing for teachers. We're going to go to the phones. Sandy from Fort Lauderdale wants to talk about the pay issue, paying teachers what they're worth. Hi, Sandy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think that the intentions of people who are addressing this are well-intentioned. I think they're looking for good ways to get affordable housing, especially for teachers. My concern is that if we do this, it seems to me that it allows people who are paying teachers to get a free pass to continue to pay teachers far less than they deserve. These are professionals who've been through college, they work hard, and yet there's a real suppression throughout the country of what teachers are paid. They talk about politicians not doing their jobs unless they get paid enough, and they're certainly paid at least $174,000 a year, whereas teachers can't afford to feed their families. So I think that's my first concern. My second concern is that this is not a new idea. There have been company towns since the Industrial Revolution and probably before that, and in Florida especially, when we have migrant workers who are in the orange
In the fields.
It's an orange.
Right.
Thank you. There were also these affordable housing for them, but they increasingly became untenable. They were allowed to go into decay, and these people were treated shabbily. Those are my concerns.
Thank you so much, Sandy. Those are valid concerns, whether or not providing housing will now be an excuse for not giving teachers raises. You guys have affordable housing. Perhaps you don't need more money. We know the average starting salary for a teacher in Miami-Dade hovers at about $42,000 a year. We're going to go to Chris from Coral Gables. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to add a comment about any teachers who may not want to live on the campus housing, and I know that many teachers in our system are still single. The Miami Association of Realtors is heading up a national pilot program converting shipping containers into housing units. And we have partnered with Miami-Dade County government and other governments, in particular, the first one's going to be in the city of South Miami, where we find these small out parcels of land, usually too small to build conventionally on. They wouldn't have the proper setbacks or whatever you need, but they would be very suitable for a housing unit about the size of a shipping container. Our first project is in South Miami, and it's going to be something that we will break out throughout the county. The county
and Chris, has this project been approved already with zoning and everything within the county?
Yes, the county is behind it 100%, and now finding the parcels of land we do have to get variances from the various cities if we're in a city. So, for example, we've gotten the variances from South Miami. We have gotten the approvals from county if there's any county-owned land. And if we find land in other municipalities, we'll also have to go through whatever it takes to get the approvals. But the good news is that the county commission is behind it 100%, and it is a very affordable housing situation, particularly when you consider the fact that somewhere out in Medley, in a lot somewhere, there's thousands of one-way shipping containers that will never be used again for any other purpose if we can't recycle them.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Well, there is a novel idea of shipping containers for homes. It sounds like paralleling the tiny house movement that we're talking about, if that will be an answer. Carolyn, you wanted to add something.
I think any idle land that is safe to live on should be considered for housing in development. However, if we're going to talk about that, right, if we're going to talk about shipping containers, we're going to talk about tiny houses, you know, an area that there's a lot of land that's idle, the churches own a lot of land, and they're not building or doing anything. So if we're going to start doing the creative thing, like make it a comprehensive thing, what can we do to develop all the available land to build housing for the county? I think if they approached it that way, more inclusive, we might get a better result.
I think we have Laura now. Yes. Hi, Laura. We got you.
Okay, thank you. I think that this discussion of housing begs the issue of what's really going on, which is our teachers are not paid enough, and that we need to be talking to our congressmen, our state legislature, about why teachers are not getting salaries that are large enough that allows them to live in the communities where they teach and choose their own housing, not trying to provide housing for them. And I think the other question is, why are we allowing the politicians to get away with this? The young people are saying, we're calling BS. I think we ought to be calling BS, because teachers have been put at the bottom of the rung for way too long, and they need higher salaries.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for that perspective. And we're hearing this a lot, which is pay teachers enough to be able to live here. Just pay them. Go ahead, Rosemary.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, back to Tallahassee, which is where the money flows from, they, at the same time they get all this credit for $400 million to harden schools and do mental health, what they allowed for Broward and 47 cents increase in the per pupil allotment. And from that 47 cent increase from state lawmakers, we're going to give, what kind of raises is that going to lead
Absolutely.
To? You know, it's, right. They took credit for responding to the shooting, but the underlying issue of supporting public schools and the people who teach our kids, they whiffed on.
Yes, what they set aside for schools and to harden them, clearly they were pushed into, they were goaded into, they were not headed in that direction before February 14th.
All right, this will be an ongoing conversation. Affordable housing in Miami-Dade. We'll be hearing more about these proposals, tiny houses, housing teachers on campuses. Thank you so much, Nancy Ankrum, for joining us in this conversation. Nancy Ankrum is the editorial page director at the Miami Herald.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And Carolyn Gunness, thank you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, after reports of violence, low pay, and deplorable conditions in Florida's juvenile lockup facilities, reform is on its way. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Nadege Green. Governor Rick Scott signed juvenile justice reforms into law. Florida detention and probation officers will see a pay raise for the first time in a decade. Money will go to updating broken and outdated surveillance cameras. And in a move to become more transparent, lawmakers, prosecutors, and public defenders will be allowed to visit and inspect juvenile lockups unannounced. This wave of change comes after the Miami Herald reported a series called Fight Club. It revealed a host of problems in Florida juvenile justice system, including rampant violence, sexual misconduct, lax oversight, and questionable hiring practices. Josie Ashton worked for the Department of Juvenile Justice for 3.5 years, and she saw the hiring practices there.
Their hiring practices is basically, if you can breathe and talk and walk, yeah, we want you here. You know, you willing to take $8.50, $9 an hour? Sure, come work with us.
Carol Marvin Miller is an investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. She reported the Fight Club series, and she joins us from WFSU in Tallahassee.
Hi, Nadesh.
Hey, Carol. Thank you so much for joining us. So good to hear you. Carol, you reported this 6-part series that blew open what was happening at DJJ. How do some of these proposed reforms address the problems that you found?
Well, I think the reforms that passed the legislature this year and the budget enhancements are a good first step. There were challenges to more meaningful reform and challenges to more money being brought to bear. In particular, the greatest challenge for the budget was the unanticipated expenditure of $400 million for school security and mental health upgrades that were occasioned by the shooting deaths at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, and a shortfall in corporate income taxes and increases in Medicaid enrollment. And so additional funds for raises, for example, for the youth care workers at the 53 privately run facilities, really, though, it just wasn't going to be this year. There is a $2 million expenditure for retention bonuses just to bring some of those guys and gals up a little bit. But in terms of recurring raises for folks in those privately run facilities, it's going to be a year before that can happen.
Now, through your series and follow-up reporting since then, the department's hiring practices have come under close scrutiny from your reporting. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found, what was happening with hiring at DJJ that caused concern?
Well, the biggest problem is that both for the officers in the 21 lockups and the folks who work at the private, mostly for-profit facilities, the pay is terrible. A private worker is probably getting paid $20,000 or less. The lockup officers aren't being paid a whole lot more. And so in Florida, they were getting what they paid for. But there was very little meaningful investigation going on before some of these folks were hired. We discovered that washed out former prison guards, folks who were fired by the Department of Corrections for wrongdoing, for having sex with inmates or introducing contraband or sleeping on the job, those folks were just sprinkled throughout the system because folks in hiring at DJJ were not digging deep into their backgrounds. And these were records that were readily available to the Miami Herald and are readily available to the Department of Juvenile Justice.
So were they just not looking for it or turning a blind eye?
They weren't looking. And one of the first things DJJ administrators did, even before we published the series, when they realized what we were looking at and what we were about to report, was they overhauled their hiring practices. And now the policy is, if we are hiring someone who formerly worked at a sister state agency, we've got to pull the personnel records, we have to look at discipline, inspector general reports, et cetera.
Now, there were deadly consequences from what was happening at DJJ. You reported about just violence happening, and this violence also being instigated by the workers there. You had Elod Revolt, a student, a young person who was there, who was killed in a fight. Allegedly, you know, some of the workers would offer fast food or honey buns as incentive for young people to fight. Is that being addressed in any way?
I'm not sure about that. When we interviewed DJJ secretary in Miami, Christy Daly, her contention was that they were not aware of a pervasive problem of officers and youth workers instigating fights. We found that very difficult to believe because our reporting was based upon records that we obtained from the state. And so we found that there were alleged incidents of so-called honey bunny going on.
And honey bunny is what it's called when someone is given food incentive to fight.
Right. We found guards instigating fights going on in every corner of the state, and we saw records that indicated this had been going on for at least a decade. Going back to your question, one of the reasons why we felt very confident that this was a pervasive systemic problem was that the details were common everywhere you looked. The incidents were called honey bunnings. A youth who carried out an attack on behalf of a guard would be called the honey bunner. Someone who endured such an attack was said to have been honey bunned. And the language was consistent everywhere we looked.
If you want to add to this conversation, to talk about juvenile justice reform, you can call us at 800-473-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. We're talking to Carol Marvin Miller, an investigative reporter with the Miami Herald, who broke open what was happening at DJJ when it comes to oversight and some of the questionable hiring practice, sexual misconduct, and violence happening there. Carol, this reform and some of the steps being taken is a solid step forward. We saw that in some of your reporting, video played a very integral role to being able to report this series. You were able to see what was happening through public records requests. There will be an investment in $1 million in aging video surveillance. I know that you reported also that in some cases, the video cameras weren't working to corroborate some of the instances of violence. Is this important that they're investing now in the video infrastructure?
Well, it's extremely important. The inability of surveillance cameras to capture what was going on inside these facilities was a persistent problem, again, going back at least two decades. We found cases in which investigations into misconduct had been hindered by lapses in video equipment, what looked like deliberate tampering with equipment. And the $1 million that was set aside for replacing aged, decrepit surveillance equipment is a step in the right direction. I'm not convinced that they will be able to upgrade every surveillance system in the state for $1 million, but it looks like there is a commitment from some in the legislature to continue the process.
We're talking about, you know, these very specific reforms. There will be money going to this. There will be more transparency. But how do you change the culture of a place? You talked about having workers who would watch these fights. You've reported, and we have seen surveillance cameras that were working, but they were turned away from the fight so that they would not capture them. Some of those things can't be regulated through rules. So how are they addressing the culture of that space so that this does not persist?
Well, that's an excellent question. Every one that we spoke with during the 2 years that we reported this story, my partner, Audra Birch, and I, everyone we spoke with said the same thing. The overarching problem, the most significant problem, was this culture of brutality, a culture of cover-up in which youth workers protected each other at the expense of children. And that is a very intractable problem. But there are things that can be done. Number one, we have to upgrade the staff at these facilities. Other states require either a college degree or some years of experience within juvenile justice or a related field. And that gives you hopefully a higher caliber of employee. Other states attempt to tamp down on the violence by different policies within the facilities that instead of emphasizing control over kids, emphasize treatment and rehabilitation.
And that's what this is supposed to be clear, for young people who end up in some of these programs. It's supposed to be, that's the main point, is rehabilitation, is it not?
It is. And if you interview anyone who works at the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice, they will insist that it is, at its core, a rehabilitative system, except there are sort of malignant strains that remain from a long history of DJJ having a punitive philosophy. They call the system tough love, but we reported that for many years the emphasis was on tough, not love. And one of the things that has to happen is that we have to retrain the staff in these facilities. We have to hire new staff who don't see themselves as prison guards for kids, but see themselves as counselors and folks who are there to help kids change their behavior for the better.
And there have been challenges with DJJ and the private providers who hire their own staff. Do these reforms extend to the private providers, the company that operate the state's 53 residential program for juveniles?
Not entirely. The overhaul of hiring practices, for example, in which DJJ announced that they would do a much better job vetting candidates, does not appear to hold sway over the private providers. And we reported that in the project. And one of the problems is that DJJ has control over these folks by virtue of their contracting system. And yet, when we interviewed them, we did not hear anything. We didn't see anything that suggested they intended to overhaul their contracting system so that the private providers would immediately be held to the same standards that the state says it will now hold itself.
And transparency. Transparency is huge in this. They talked about, in these new reforms, getting, you know, public defenders and people being able to walk in and inspect unannounced, and even having reporters be able to come in. This was part of this. Do you see that happening?
I do see that happening. The two men who sponsored that legislation, Jeff Brandis, senator, and a House member by the name of David Richardson, were very excited about having the opportunity to go into these facilities without warning and walk around, look at the physical plant, interview the kids. David Richardson has been doing this with some regularity in adult prisons, and his actions, his oversight of those facilities, I think you could argue effectively, is one of the reasons why conditions have improved, at worst around the margins and at best more substantially.
Thank you so much, Carol. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for sharing on your reporting and the important work that you do in keeping these institutions accountable. That was Carol Marvin Miller, investigative reporter with the Miami Herald. Thank you so much. That will do it for the Florida Roundup. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Help this week from the amazing Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Afrontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor is Jason Zapka. I'm Nadege Green. Thanks for listening and calling.